Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Both the Rick Scott and Charlie Crist campaigns are trying to score political points off what's now being called Fangate, the moment Scott initially refused to debate Crist due to the presence of Crist's electric fan.
But I waited until we figured out if he was going to show up. He said he wasn't going to come to the debate. So why come out until he's ready?
Also this week, a billboard in Florida's capital city advertises bulletproof vests for children. Creators of the parody ad say it's not far from becoming real.
And the way to do something about it is to go to the ballot box and to vote for politicians that are supportive of protecting our children.
We'll also find how many Floridians could have health care under the Medicaid program but don't. We'll also learn how two otherwise nice people are being portrayed as evil incarnate in political ads on TV. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. The second of three Florida gubernatorial debates happened this week, but most of the attention is being paid to a spat over an electric fan. Lynn Hatter reports some pundits are calling it one of the most bizarre moments in recent Florida political history.
Okay, here's how it all started.
We have been told that Governor Scott will not be participating in this debate.
That's debate moderator CBS 4's Elliot Rodriguez trying to explain to viewers and listeners of the Florida Press Association Leadership Florida debate why there was only one candidate on stage, Charlie Crist. The culprit, an electronic fan on the floor of Crist's podium, which the Scott campaign and debate organizers say was against the rules.
The debate rules, as it pertains to electronic devices, was that they were not to be permitted, and that did include fans.
That's Florida Press Association President Dean Writings. The Crist campaign submitted a signed contract for the debate, but included a handwritten caveat that said any temperature issues would be addressed by the presence of a fan. Writings says he saw the note, but was preoccupied with trying to address a lawsuit brought by Libertarian candidate Adrian Wiley.
And the partners were actually focused on the defense at that moment. We did see it. I received the email myself. I did note. And of course, the partners want to make sure that all candidates are comfortable during a debate. So if there had been a temperature issue, we would have certainly been willing to address it. So I didn't have a concern about the comment.
The temperature an hour before the debate was 67 degrees. In the preceding hour, the electric oscillator appeared at the base of Crist's podium. By 7 p.m., when the debate started, stuff hit the fan.
All anyone is talking about today is Fangate. Folks. Clearly, for Scott's campaign, last night, blue. And if you turn the switch the other way, it sucked.
Comedian Stephen Colbert of Comedy Central's Colbert Report lampooned the debate performance. And Florida State University political scientist Carol Weisert says the whole Fangate affair has once again made Florida into a national joke.
In the day after, I think what we've seen is, again, dismay, because this is just sets Florida up for ridicule. It's quite annoying and totally undeserved and unnecessary, I think.
Meanwhile, absent from the fray but still very much a part of the gubernatorial race is Libertarian Adrian Wiley. So far, he's been left out of both debates, but in response to Wednesday's debate debacle, Wiley told the Associated Press he's the only adult in the room. Wiley has sought to distance himself from both Scott and Crist.
That's what we've seen throughout this election. My opponents really aren't talking about their plan or, you know, what they're going to do to make the lives of Floridians better. They're just essentially attacking one another, and that's extremely sad.
Recent polls show Scott and Crist in a dead heat. Wiley is getting around 10% support. It may not be enough to win the election, but it could be enough to guarantee neither Scott nor Crist will breeze to victory. The third and final gubernatorial debate will be October 21st, televised on CNN. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
A billboard in Tallahassee is advertising bulletproof vests for children. As Jessica Palumbo reports, the group behind the provocative campaign wants to make Florida voters think about policies like the Stand Your Ground law before they cast ballots in the midterm election.
Picture this. You're driving westward down one of Tallahassee's main roads.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham.
Appalachie Parkway eventually runs right into the state Capitol building. But you're waiting here at a light at the Capitol Circle intersection. It's one of the busiest in town. Then you see it, a billboard high above a KFC restaurant. It appears to just be an ad for vests, like you'd see an ad for back-to-school fleece vests or something. It says, on sale now, a smiling child with his arms outstretched, smiling, looking directly at the viewer. It says, bulletproof vest for boys, and there's a price right under it, $149.99. In the shadows under the billboard, several people wait at a bus stop. Sean Frederick is on his way home from working a restaurant shift. He's looking at the image of the small child in the bulletproof vest for the first time.
What do you say, the picture's worth a thousand words? That's heartbreaking to me right now.
Like the kid in the ad, Frederick is black. He says he thinks the billboard's message is to put down the guns. Eventually, the conversation turns to racism.
You experienced racism recently?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Most recently, he says, when he got on the bus in his all-black work uniform, he noticed people looking at him a certain way.
This is a uniform. Based on a uniform of an individual, you perceive a lot. Okay, but what is it actually? Your perceptions aren't always the truth.
The billboard's creators say this conversation about perception, about recognizing the humanity in all people, is exactly what they hope to start.
This isn't about a gun. This is about who uses the gun and who they see when they're walking on the street.
Philip Agnew directs a group called the Dream Defenders. It sprang up after the shooting death of unarmed black Florida teenager Trayvon Martin. Now Dream Defenders is behind the Tallahassee billboard and a website that make up the Vest or Vote campaign. A video on the site shows a teary-eyed mother getting her teenage son ready for school.
Mom, are you serious? I'm not going to wear that vest.
I need to know when I'm at work that you're going to be safe. Do it for me.
All right, Mama, I'll do it for you.
Agnew says the ads reflect Florida mothers' fears because of racial profiling, police brutality, and vigilantism encouraged, he believes, by the state's controversial Stand Your Ground self-defense law. Advertiser Gerard Bush was one of the creative minds behind the bulletproof vest imagery.
And I really do not believe that it is an exaggeration. I believe that it's right around the corner.
Back at the Tallahassee bus stop, Ruby Williams is noticing the ad for the first time.
Oh, yeah, that's really neat, for kids especially. Because, you know, you never know when somebody's going to be shooting. You never know when kids are in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Adman Bush says that reaction, believing it's real, shows the campaign is successful.
I would count that as a huge win, absolutely. Would it be a huge win 2 years, 3 years, 5 years down the road after having done nothing about it?
Dream Defenders are hoping the campaign brings people out to vote for candidates who support a repeal of Stand Your Ground. They stop short of overtly endorsing a candidate, but here's what Democrat Charlie Crist said in the most recent gubernatorial debate.
When it gets to the point, and you've got a statute on the books that allows the initiator of an instigation to end up killing another human being after they started the incident, there is something fundamentally flawed with that law.
Asked whether he would repeal Stand Your Ground, Republican Governor Rick Scott reflected on the Trayvon Martin case.
I would not change the law. I think that death is a tragic death, but I believe in the right to defend yourself.
The Dream Defenders are planning a second Vest or Vote billboard for Broward County. The group plans to run the campaign until the midterm election. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Governor Rick Scott, who's made job creation the hallmark of his time in office, got some pretty good news today. The state announced the final jobless numbers before the November 4th general election could be the lowest for Florida since June of 2008. That's when Charlie Crist, Scott's Democratic challenger, occupied the governor's mansion. The Department of Economic Opportunity posted an unemployment mark for September at 6.1%. That was down from 6.3% in August. That's the second time this year, the monthly mark, based upon estimates of the number of people employed and actively seeking employment, has been announced at 6.1%. Initially, the state reported the January rate at 6.1, but that number was revised a short time later upward to 6.2. By the way, Florida's 2-point drop from August to September mirrors the federal dip in unemployment, with the national jobless mark now at 5.9%. Still to come on Capitol Report, the Florida Department of Health's proposals for low THC marijuana are being challenged in court, but officials say they're also being challenged by the law itself.
It's not very often that we get an opportunity that only gets five. It'd be like saying there's only be five medical doctors in the state of Florida.
We'll hear from a young adult aging out of Florida's foster care system who was one of the first chosen to take part in a new legislative pilot program.
It feels good. It's like being the first person on the bus in the morning. You know, you get the best seats.
We'll get the latest on Florida's Medicaid gap.
I'm sure that there will continue to be the uninsured, but the numbers will be smaller.
And we'll hear from two candidates for Congress who like each other personally, but you'd never know it by the TV ads running about them. Opponents of the Department of Health's proposed rules for distributing low-THC marijuana began a legal challenge this week. Nick Evans reports implementing the new Florida law has been a rocky, contentious ride that doesn't appear to be easing.
Florida is one of 11 states that have adopted laws allowing some citizens to use low-THC marijuana. In Florida, use is restricted to individuals suffering from symptoms like seizure and muscle spasms, but it's also restricted by the text of the law itself. The Department of Health is directed to choose five dispensing organizations that meet a number of requirements outlined in the statute. Over the past few months, department officials have held public hearings to craft a set of proposed rules, and they've come under continual fire for making their final selection by lottery. But Department of Health lawyer Jennifer Cheddar defends the process.
The difficulty in selecting something that's necessarily better when they're just different made the scorecard, an elaborate scorecard, something that seemed like an impossibility to the agency.
But Stephen Turner, lawyer for the South Florida nursery Costa Farms, says that's the sort of thing government agencies do all the time.
I don't understand why the department doesn't have the capacity to do that when other states do, when municipalities and cities do in selecting franchisees. I'm asking you to help explain why you can make the decision that they pass-fail whether they can operate, but you can't make the decision if their application is going to be, in your judgment, a better provider.
And the idea of pass-fail brings up another complaint. The department plans to evaluate applicants based on the rule, and any applications that pass will be included in the lottery. But the department also says it may ask for further information to judge applications. Craig Varn represents another nursery called Plants of Ruskin, and he argues this creates uncertainty, allowing ludicrously substandard applications like one written on a napkin to compete with high-quality applicants. But Cheddar dismisses this argument.
So if we wanted to take that napkin and say, denied, this is not a qualified application, that person would have a right to challenge that decision by the agency, and we'll deal with that then. But if we get an application on a napkin, we'll probably defend that decision all day long.
Nevertheless, Farn says, it's unclear what the applicant needs to do to be taken seriously.
Right. I don't disagree. But at some point, there's a level between my absolutely ridiculous proposition and the cream of the crop. And what I'm trying to understand is, where is that middle ground? And I think you're telling me that other than the rules, there isn't anything, but you can still potentially expect an RAI or you may not get one.
Whatever the decision in the case at hand, Cheddar says one thing is certain.
I know we're going to have litigation. Absolutely. With the number of lawyers that came to these workshops, we're going to get sued again. And it'll start the minute we get applications.
The hearings ended Wednesday, and Judge W. David Watkins will have 30 days to render his decision. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Florida is one of a number of states that has not accepted an expansion of its Medicaid program under the terms of the Federal Affordable Care Act. Alex Fondlander has an update.
Community health centers were critical in the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. They provide a safety net of health care to low-income and underserved communities, regardless of a patient's ability to pay. However, an over-reliance on these centers is putting a strain on clinics across the state.
The ACA and much of our health policy is built on the assumption that insurance coverage leads to access, which leads to better health, but that's not necessarily proven.
That's Florida State University's Marshall Kapp explaining the foundation of the ACA, which was drafted with the intention to provide health insurance to those people by giving states money to extend Medicaid coverage and federally subsidized health plans. But Aretha Jones, executive director for Neighborhood Medical Center, says the newly qualified federal health center hasn't seen a significant increase in insured patients over the past year.
We found that a lot of our patients, specifically at Neighborhood Medical Center, kind of fell through the donut hole of coverage. They didn't qualify for the Affordable Care Act because they didn't meet the income requirements. And then they did not qualify for Medicaid because they didn't meet those qualifications either.
Nearly a million Floridians gained coverage earlier this year as a result of the law. Prior to the first enrollment period, the U.S. Census Bureau reported 3.8 million Floridians under the age of 65 were uninsured. Florida lawmakers opted out of expanding Medicaid. The expansion would have extended coverage to an additional 1 million people who earn an income of up to 138% of the federal poverty level. Funding for Medicaid expansion would have been covered by the federal government in full until 2016, then gradually shift 10% of the cost to Florida by 2022. Without those dollars, Florida medical centers are left to rely on direct funding from federal, state, and local governments, as well as donors to cover the treatment of patients in the coverage gap. Tallahassee's Bond Community Health Center lost its designation as a federally qualified health center, and as a result will miss out on several million dollars of federal funding over the next few years. And while that loss came as a result of an application error, Bond Chairman Antonio Jefferson says other centers will eventually go through similar funding challenges. Still, he believes the financial strain could eventually ease up once the ACA is fully implemented.
This is a transition that I think all community health centers throughout the entire nation are going to have to go through, of now moving from having direct government funding to having your patients show up at your door with some type of health insurance that's provided through the Affordable Care Act. I'm sure that there will continue to be the uninsured, but the numbers will be smaller.
The changeover in funding will not occur as quickly as originally planned, largely because of the Medicaid coverage gap. Florida is part of a large minority of states that has not expanded Medicaid. And FSU's Marshall Kapp says that funding has directly affected the impact of the law and how health care is delivered.
The idea was that there would be very few uninsured people, and therefore the need for federally qualified health centers would greatly diminish, and that would enable the federal government over time to phase out its support of those centers. Of course, that's not the way it's worked out. That's not the way it's going to work out.
Kapp points out that the implementation of the program is still pretty much in infancy. The federal health insurance marketplace is only about to start its second year of enrollment again next month. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Alex Fondlander.
For several weeks, a group of Florida foster youth has been working at one of the state's largest state agencies as part of a legislative pilot program. As Sasha Cordner reports, the goal is to help these young adults aging out of the foster system get on the path to future employment.
Back in 2005, Brian Williams went into the foster care system when he was a teenager. He later left when he was 18. The 22-year-old says overall it wasn't bad, but it was a big learning experience.
After I aged out, you know, moved on my own, been on my own ever since. You know, I always had my own place. Had some jobs, you know, in and out. Did school.
I didn't graduate high school until after I aged out. And then I went to Lively Technical, got two trades from there for electronic technology and computer technology. Then I went in TCC to major in criminal justice.
He says he's faced several obstacles while in foster care, and he says the one that comes to mind the most is not having that peer mentor.
Not having that leadership, I want to say. It's not having that one person there that you could relate to. You know, by us being younger, we want someone who's around our age or who's not too far, who's basically being a role model. I guess we didn't have that, so it's just hard to relate to a lot of the older people.
That's why he says he's excited to be chosen for a legislative pilot program where he's now working as an IT and telecommunications specialist at the Florida Department of Agriculture Technology Services.
Basically, we're the technology group for the phone lines, phones, computers, software uploads, the system database. I had the IT job before. I didn't stay there long, so this is actually a step up. This, like, doesn't compare to just working, you know, somewhere like in the library with computers. This is something bigger than that.
It's sort of like an internship crossed with a part-time job.
That's Erin Gillespie, spokeswoman for the Ag Department, which is the first state agency to offer this type of program to kids aging out of Florida's foster care system, like Williams, who was one of six chosen to participate last month.
They do have mentors assigned to them to help them develop professionally. They're going to be doing things as a group, so it's certainly more involved than, you know, a regular part-time employee, similar to an internship. So we are working with them hands-on, you know, one-on-one, to make sure that they have what they need, that they understand, and that they are growing professionally, so that if a full-time job does become available, they would be, able to apply for that.
So how did this all start?
I was in my office, and I was trying to figure out where there may be some unconventional type places that we could help our kids in foster care and those that had been in foster care. So it just occurred to me, a lot of times they don't have much of a resume when they get out the other side. They're going out into the marketplace looking for gainful employment, and that's a real challenge for them.
Republican Representative Ben Albritton has worked on several previous efforts aimed at helping foster kids, including a new law extending the age of foster kids from 18 to 21, and another that helps foster kids have an easier time obtaining a driver's license. He says his latest project, the Fostering Success Pilot, just builds on those efforts.
So they can go in, these kids can go in, do an internship, and learn real skills from real professionals, and have something that they can take with them the rest of their life, including a resume builder. My hope is, long-term, is this will spread through all of our government agencies, and we have places for these young people to go and participate all across state government.
And Williams, who's taking part in the program, feels the same way. He says he's not only grateful for being part of the first group to experience this type of program, he's also grateful for having a mentor like program coordinator David Struess, who's just a few years older than him.
It's like being the first person on the bus in the morning. You know, you get the best seats. You're the first person or the first group of people to get an opportunity. Then you get to lead by example, make the way, you know, a lot of the younger guys. So then we can, you know, look back years from now and say, hey, this guy David right here, he introduced us to a program that pays the way for other people. You know, we did great. So it's building a nice resume.
Meanwhile, Albritton says he's in talks with several state agencies to participate in the program. The legislature and the governor already approved about $75,000 for the pilot in this year's budget. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
You're listening to Capital Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Florida has 27 congressional districts, but the race for one of these districts has drawn interest and millions of dollars from all over the country. The contest pits two-term Republican Steve Sutherland of Panama City against Democratic challenger Gwen Graham of Tallahassee. Last month, the two clashed during a debate in Graham's hometown, but this week, when the candidates faced off again in Tallahassee before the Capitol Tiger Bay Club, the mood was totally different. Even before debate moderator Carl Cannon introduced them.
You know, I saw you guys already shake hands. If you want to do it right now.
Well, sure, for everybody here.
What about a hug?
Once the debate was underway, Graham's criticism of her Republican opponent was muted.
I've had the opportunity to meet Congressman Sutherland on multiple occasions, and you know what? I think he's a good man. I think he's a good man. We just have fundamentally different approaches to how you get things done in Washington.
Later, Sutherland noticed Graham's parents, former Florida Governor and U.S. Senator Bob Graham, and his wife Adele sitting at the front of the hall.
And Gwen, I will say, you honor your parents. I see you speak affectionately about them. I see the twinkle in your eye when you look at them, and I see the same thing in their eyes to you.
There were certainly disagreements between the two on issues such as immigration reform and climate change, but Graham bucked her own party on a number of matters.
I believe that the Democrats bit off far more than they could chew when they enacted the Affordable Care Act. And I agree with the congressman. It should not have been done, and it should not have been just shoved through without any bipartisan support.
For his part, Sutherland took pains to highlight the times he'd worked with Democrats.
I worked with Republicans and Democrats to author and co-author the Restore Act. Our own senator, Bill Nelson, was on the same conference that I was appointed to.
But even as more harmony than animus filled the Tallahassee meeting room, the district's airwaves dripped with political vitriol.
Supporting Obamacare? Liberal Washington insider? Handpicked and paid for by Pelosi? Don't be fooled. That's the Pelosi-Graham way.
It's easy for Steve Sutherland to play games when he said his $174,000 salary is not so much. He's still getting paid. But in Florida, he's risking jobs, retirement savings, even delaying veterans' benefits. It's irresponsible.
Sutherland says he hates those kinds of attacks.
I think today and perhaps going forward, you're going to hear a lot of things accusing me of things that just aren't true.
Graham says she doesn't care very much for them either.
I would like to concur with Congressman Sutherland's recognition that there is way too much outside money in this race. And the outside ads that are being run against me, there's not a single one of them that's true.
While both candidates have raised more than $1 million each for their own ads, some of which, to be perfectly frank, aren't exactly complimentary towards the opponent, many millions more have been poured in from the Republican and Democratic parties and other entities apart from the candidates' campaigns. Speaking afterwards, Sutherland remarked the candidates' actual messages were getting washed away in the tsunami of outside attack ads. A bipartisan point of agreement in a contest that has turned far nastier than the candidates themselves. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Nick Evans, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank Alex Fondlander and our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.